Hello and welcome back to Heights Libraries Podcast, Unpacking 1619, where you can explore the interviews we've collected with scholars from around the country, in which we unpack topics relating to race in America. I'm your host, John Pichet, and I'm thrilled to share these interviews with you here. New York University professor Pamela Newkirk and I talk about her book, Diversity Incorporated, The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business. We discuss the history of exclusion, the role of Presidents Johnson and Reagan, and why higher education is such a battleground for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Here is our conversation from September 14th, 2022.
I'm Pamela Newkirk, and I believe I'm here because you're interviewing me about my latest book, Diversity, Inc. And I'm a professor at New York University and a journalist, and that's it.
Perfect. Thank you for the introduction. And as you said, we are talking about your new book, Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business. And could you maybe give us a little overview of how you came to write the book and what you learned while doing it?
Sure. So, yeah, what motivated me to write the book is that for the many years that I have worked both in academia and in journalism, diversity had been a preoccupation of just like every newsroom I worked in and once I joined the faculty at New York University. And while there was so much talk about diversity, I noticed that every place I had worked, there was no diversity. In three of four newsrooms I worked in, I was the only African-American reporter for a long time at New York University. I was the only tenured African-American woman in the entire College of Arts and Science. So not just in journalism, but that covered every field in history, English, mathematics. And so I wanted to interrogate the tension between the incessant talk about diversity, the multi-billion-dollar industry that had blossomed around it with the chief diversity officers and, you know, these bloated operations that existed in law firms and in just about every company, and the lack of diversity. So what was it that had occurred over the past 50 years that diversity has been this dominant, you know, buzzword in our culture? What had happened to make diversity such a topic of conversation, yet resulting in no diversity? So that was the impetus for the book.
Well, thank you for that overview. And I think we should probably start with an idea of, we're coming to some consensus about what diversity means. And, you know, not only in the context of kind of what you're talking about, this business aspect, but also in a larger kind of corporate or business culture.
Yeah, so that was part of what I wanted to look at. So when we say diversity, what do we even mean? And one of the things that I discovered early on is that diversity has come to mean all things to all people. Diversity could mean everything from geographic diversity to racial diversity to gender diversity to ableism diversity. And so I wanted to specifically look at racial diversity because I think that because diversity has become this umbrella that covers so much that it really had no bearing on racial diversity. In other words, a company could consider itself diverse and have no people of color, right? And it also assumes that people of color don't also fall under the umbrella of, everything from gender to economics to geography. So I wanted to specifically look at racial diversity so that we can have a conversation that actually meant something, that we could all be on the same page. So in that way, I can look at the data to determine how race had fared over this 50-year-long conversation about diversity. So that's what I focused on. And I focused on the four largest racial minority groups.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think you found that it hasn't fared very well, racial diversity.
Right. So if you look at it, so when you say diversity, if you looked at gender diversity, women have fared much better since this conversation began 50 years ago. But if you look at race, people of color have not really made many strides in decades. And in fact, in many fields, their numbers have fallen.
Well, and I think we should probably go back to this 50-year mark and kind of talk about, because in the book you talk, kind of begin with Johnson and the Great Society that he created, and talk a little bit about the Kerner Commission and this movement that was really like a promise of inclusion and fixing the wrong, and then how that moved into this.
Right. So yeah, it's a lot of history to try to put into a minute or two. But yeah, so after the civil rights movement, there was this growing recognition of race and how it had impacted specifically African Americans. The civil rights movement largely was focused on inequality in this nation and how African Americans had fared. And so there were a number of touch points, but one was the Kerner Commission report that you mentioned. President Johnson had impaneled the National Commission of Civil Disorders, which the shorthand is the Kerner Report, and that panel looked at a number of things. It looked at housing, education, and how African Americans were faring in all of these different categories. And what it found is that race had played such a role in how African Americans lived, where they went to school, how they were depicted in the media. And it basically talked about injustice and how America and our government was implicated in the perpetuation of injustice against African Americans. And so as a result of this landmark report, the Kerner Commission report, Johnson implemented a number of measures, and I mean his Great Society programs were targeted at correcting many of these problems, this kind of injustice. And it was aimed at housing and education and hospitals and like just desegregating all of these institutions that had locked out African Americans and kept them from progressing in society. And to a large degree, the programs made a huge difference. The number of African Americans who were graduating not only from colleges and universities, but also from high school, made a huge difference. And because what it did is it unlocked the doors of progress that had been firmly shut to African Americans. And so over years, we saw the needle move. We saw African Americans moving into fields that had long denied them access, including journalism, including universities. And so we saw the needle move. And then with the election of Ronald Reagan, we saw many of those programs dismantled. And then we saw a lot of backsliding, and those numbers from that point on, so from the 1980s on, we haven't really seen much progress when we look at the inclusion of African Americans, and if we're looking at any influential field, the numbers have barely budged over the past several decades, three, four decades.
Yeah, that's interesting that the Reagan administration basically defunded a lot of these and then unregulated. Is that the...
Yeah, and really stigmatized the kind of progress that had been made. You know, there were all of these attacks on affirmative action. There was just this sense that the people who were really disadvantaged were white Americans, not you know, populations who had long been denied access to the American dream, essentially.
That's right. And you looked at several different industries, and I kind of want to focus on U.S. education, if that's okay.
Oh, sure.
Because, I mean, you did talk about Coca-Cola, the NFL, and the film industry. If you want to kind of briefly talk about that, but I want to kind of spend the majority talking about higher education, because I think it's such an illustration of how inclusion is, well, we'll get to it in a minute. But.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to talk about academia. You know, I wanted to look at influential fields and the ones that really can be a game changer. So higher education, to me, is probably one of the most important fields to look at, because it can make the difference between opportunity and the lack of opportunity. So, yeah, I did pay sustained attention to higher education for that reason.
One of the things that I, when reading the film industry, kind of that entertainment aspect, I read a headline the other day about Netflix moving back from some of their diversity programming to kind of focus more on middle America. So it's not only timely, but it's also instructive on kind of how you work further. Yeah.
And just think of middle America as if that does not include African Americans and other people of color. And that's just the point. You know, when we're talking about diversity, we're really thinking about what gets normalized and what is not. And so what has become normalized in our society is the exclusion of now what is 40% of the population, racial minorities, right? And so when we go into these environments, whether it's a film company or a university, we've normalized the exclusion of people of color. And that is why African Americans make up something like 4% of university professors, Hispanics like 3%. You know, so, and that becomes just the norm, as if, you know, people who are, you know, African Americans and Latinos alone are like 30% of the population. And yet we just don't expect them to be included in these spaces, whether it's a museums or, you know, the top tier of corporations, or we just have normalized their exclusion. So when I think of diversity, I'm not only thinking of some rosy picture of like, we are the world. I'm thinking about who gets included when we're talking about opportunity in America, when we're talking about the American dream, who is that dream for? What is the intent of that dream? And so, because it's easy to just talk about diversity as something that's just feel good, instead of talking about it as an issue of justice, right?
When I was thinking too while you were speaking, that like, you know, the white space seems to be, if you include even one character of color or person of color, somehow that's no longer a white space,
right?
And then it excludes,
and then it's and then it's diverse, right?
Right, but then it also is like, by inclusion, then you're excluding the majority of white people. And that, so like Netflix saying we're going to focus on the middle of America, it's code word for we're moving back into white stories and white, you know.
main characters and that kind of stuff. And that's,
and even though, you know, it's counterintuitive that study after study has shown that diverse casts make the most money or the most lucrative, whether we're talking about the box office or a television show. And yet it's just this issue of what we normalize, right?
Well, then I kind of want to use this too to kind of talk about, excuse me, you talk in the book about campus hostility and the things that minorities had to face when they started being included into these traditionally white segregated spaces. And this isn't things that happened in the 30s. This is stuff that happened in our lifetime.
And so, still happens, actually, yeah.
Maybe you could speak a little bit about how the campus hostility and some of the, you know, the first inroads of diversity and what they had to face.
Yeah, well, you know, I just think it's the history of our country, because our country is rooted in racial hierarchies and in racial exclusion. We have normalized that. And so people of color in spaces that had long been exclusively white is still jarring to some. And that was true in the 1960s, and it's still true today. And that's the unfortunate part of the research, because the data is just a reflection of attitudes and how little they have really changed, even though we managed to elect Barack Obama as a president, like for 8 years, and that has given people the sense that we've overcome our racial issues of racial discrimination. But if you look at the data, you see that the needle has barely moved in decades. That what is that reflecting? It's reflecting these hardwired attitudes in our society that have not changed as much as we would like to think they have.
Some of the reasons why they haven't changed, I think, are because, and this, I was struck by this in your book about the, in the chapters about education, minorities are left to do the work and they're responsible for making everyone feel comfortable. So like when you were talking about Halloween costumes, you know, we don't want to, the white response is we don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, but really what they want to, we want to be racist. Is what they're basically saying.
And we want you to be comfortable with it. We don't want you to make a big deal of it.
Exactly. And that emotional work is left to the minority person in the white space. And that seems to be.
But I guess that has been our history, right? And so people of color are the ones who have to figure out how to fit into these spaces, but those spaces don't have to make any adjustments to accommodate other people and other cultures and other ways of thinking about justice. And so, yeah, you know, race, it's such a huge, huge topic, right? Our country is just has always been shadowed by this issue of race and the tension between our ideals and the reality of how we actually live with race, and it's often been a struggle. It's a struggle for everyone. It's a struggle for many white Americans, because, you know, when you talk about education, we're talking about inculcated values and ideas. And so when we look at even our premier institutions, for so many centuries, they have embedded these ideas of race and you know, white superiority and black inferiority. And this is not just something I'm throwing around. These were actual ideas that were rooted in science and in anthropology and in English literature. And everywhere you turn, there was this notion of racial superiority when you think of whites, and inferiority when you think of blacks and others. And so we have not quite dismantled these systems of oppression that are embedded in the academy. And so how could we expect just everyday people not to harbor certain attitudes about other people and really fear about other people and what those people represent? Right. So that's why education is so key. And that's why we're still seeing today these battles over curricula. What could be taught? What can't be taught? We can't teach students about slavery. Why? Because that makes white students uncomfortable. Yet that is our history. And we're still living with the repercussions of that history, right? And so until we find a way to actually address the roots of racial injustice and that are rooted in these kind of horrific, pernicious attitudes around race, until we can actually tackle that, we're never going to make progress with diversity, because if people are stigmatized, demonized, thought of less than, of course they're not going to be included in influential fields. Of course they're not going to, you're not going to see them in boardrooms and in universities and leadership positions. So education is so central to this whole conversation about diversity, because it's not something that you can just hire away, that you can just like hire a chief diversity officer and voila, you're going to have diversity. First, you have to really tackle these attitudes that have kept us from living in a truly just society.
Yeah, and I appreciated how you kind of illustrated those systems of, so you pointed to two books. One was this two-volume Negro Education, which kind of instituted this idea that African Americans should only go into manual labor, and they weren't, industrial education, focusing on agriculture, which of course harkens back to the slave systems, right, and that kind of stuff.
And this was this report was issued by the U.S. Education Department, right? Highly influential, and it's kind of directing the course of education, this dual track educational system, one for whites and one for blacks, right? And so these are the embedded ideas that we're still wrestling with, that we're still living with. When you think of anthropology and how for centuries or more than a century, students at every influential school were taught that you had Europeans who were the most intellectually advanced, and at the bottom you had Africans who were barbaric, basically. In one encyclopedia, Africans were compared to apes, and there were these like very fancy terms to describe their lack of advancement. So all of these ways of thinking, the pseudoscience that was mainstreamed into places like Harvard and Princeton and Yale and Columbia University, we're still living with that. And we see it reflected in film. We see it reflected in literature. And so that is part of the work that has to be done before we can even, significantly address the matter of diversity.
Well, and let's talk about the work as it is done, as you said, by diversity programs, and kind of like, is it enough to just hire a diversity manager or do a training or do, you know, in service, and what are the successes and what are the failures of these programs that we all kind of experience?
Yeah, so many studies have concluded that not only does training not help advance the cause of diversity, but in many instances, they make the problem worse. They trigger a backlash to diversity. They cause those who already were indifferent to become sort of against diversity. And I know I've seen that in my own experience. These training programs are often painful for everyone involved. Like, no one wants to sit through that, right? And so so training doesn't work. And yet that is the primary way that many institutions try to address issues of diversity. Chief diversity officers, there's a very high turnover. One study showed that the majority of chief diversity officers don't even have access to the data in their own institutions that would allow them to see where the problems lie. And if you can't see where the problems are, how can you fix them, right? So there's a lot of frustration among chief diversity officers, very high turnover. Yet these are the ways that many institutions are basically paying lip service to diversity rather than really doing the work. And what does the work look like? One of the places that I looked, well, I actually looked at two. One was Columbia University, where you had a president who made diversity one of the primary missions of his tenure. And then you had Coca-Cola that, after a landmark discrimination lawsuit settlement, they looked at all of the ways that inequality had sort of calcified in the corporation. So they looked at everything from salaries to bonuses to, where people were, what levels they were, and they looked across race, across gender. And what they found was probably not that surprising. They found that African Americans made far less than even their peers, people in the same rank, same position as they held. They found that African Americans were kind of clustered in the lowest levels of the company, that they had fewer bonuses, fewer opportunities for advancement. They found all of the things that you could probably find in many institutions, but there was transparency. So that you were actually able, because they opened it up in a way that you can actually see how injustice had become embedded in the entire institution, right? And once they could see that, then they could go about changing it by having like a lot of sunlight on it. So anytime someone was hired, they would look at, well, what did the candidate pool look like? How diverse was the candidate pool? They looked at, why wasn't this person hired, this person who was more qualified? Oh, well, maybe because they were a diverse candidate. So anyway, they were able to look across all of these categories, and over a period, I believe, of like 5 years, they were able to actually change the culture and the complexion of the workplace and have a far more diverse company along, every level, every category in the company. And you saw far more diverse leadership. And so that was one example. And I can't really go through it I wrote a book because these things are complicated, right? But so that was one example about how you actually can go about changing an institution and making it more diverse. And the other place I looked was Columbia University, where Lee Bollinger had made it a mission, because he was at the University of Michigan when diversity was really challenged in higher education in two cases. And so he brought all that he learned from those lawsuits to Columbia University. And anyway, the bottom line is, what it takes to achieve diversity is leadership, intention, and there has to be some kind of accountability, right? You have to be able to actually have a plan and some kind of accountability and the leadership that cares to make a difference. Without that, you'll have more of the same. And what we have now in our society are many institutions that are doing the same things over and over and over that don't work, that will ensure that they will continue to have these homogenous workplaces.
Right. And I think you kind of end the book with this idea that, you know, white America is the one that really has to make these changes. You can't expect that the minorities and the groups that are trying to diversify the workplace to do all the heavy lifting. You know, the resentment and the backlash and the lawsuits of, you know, people who are saying, well, I was excluded because I was white. Those are the things that we have to fight against.
Yeah, but it's not easy to fight against those things when you have people in leadership who are perpetuating this idea of white victimization, right? Who are not actually looking at the numbers, which show that white Americans are still pretty much holding most of the positions. In fact, they're holding the lion's share of positions, even in places where they are themselves racial minorities. And so, you know, without a clear-eyed look at what's actually happening, and not, you know, that's not like based on the fears that are fueled by all of this misinformation about, you know, people are taking over, they're taking out jobs, they're taking out. I mean, the numbers show that that's actually not what's happening. So, but it goes back to education and the ability to think critically, right? And that's something that we seem to be struggling with in this country right now.
Well, if you have any parting words and hope for diversity in the workplace, what would they be for the future? Because I know you end the book with some.
I guess the biggest takeaway is there's not rocket science, that we can achieve diversity, that there are blueprints to follow for those institutions that are serious about it. But for those that are not, they can keep doing the same thing and they will get the same results.
Thanks for listening to Unpacking 1619. For more information on Heights Library 1619 Project Discussion Group, or to check out more interviews with scholars, please visit heightslibrary.org. See you next episode, wherever you listen to podcasts.